Three little verses this morning, packed with truth for us. Hebrews 12, beginning in verse 1. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and the perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured a cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. This morning, entitled the message, The Long Look. When I was 7 years old, I had the privilege of accompanying my grandfather in his semi, as we went down to California. We left from Minnesota, and we traveled many miles down to Los Angeles, is where my trip went. And I remember a lot of different things about that trip. I remember we went by the Devil's Slide in Utah, just a bunch of jagged rocks going down the side of the mountain, and it looks like they were put there on purpose. I remember stopping at a truck stop in Arizona about 2 o'clock in the morning. That was our supper. I slept until we had supper that night at this little truck stop in the middle of the mountains. Remember when we got into Nevada, every truck stop we went into had slot machines that you had to run through before you got to the counter, before you could get to your food. You had to go through this mini casino. I remember when we got into California, we were driving along the road, just desert, and three golden eagles swooped down with their huge 8-foot wingspans and came within about 15, 20 feet of the truck. It was just amazing, just beautiful. I remember the air ride seats that they're filled with air and you get to bounce on. I couldn't do much because I wasn't very heavy at the time, but my grandpa could make them go down and up. And I remember the CB, let me talk on the CB, and the air horn. You get to do that every once in a while. But one thing I'll never forget is those miles and miles and miles of long, straight road. We don't have many of those here in Pennsylvania. But out west, they have miles and miles and miles of long, straight road. You can see the road just kind of melt away into the distant horizon. And I could see the mountains off in the distance, but it took forever for us to reach them. And it seemed like our destination was always just beyond that next set of mountains. So even though you could see that mountain range off in the distance, And you knew that our destination was just the other side of those mountains, it seemed like it took forever to get there. This morning, our author is trying to get us and to get his audience to see this life as a road of sorts, a very long road, down which he encourages them to take the long look toward their destination, a destination that for them, too, is just beyond that far set of mountains. But as we look at life's long road, we understand that it requires a lifelong game plan. So how is it that we're supposed to successfully navigate life's long road? And the author here gives us a 4-point game plan that we're supposed to follow. I think it's going to help us a little bit if we look at how this passage is structured just a little. And so looking at those first two verses, he begins with, therefore, and he connects this text to the passage that precedes it. The passage that we've called the Hall of Faith. And the one that he's given us all these examples of those who've gone before, those who've finished well. In fact, he wraps up in chapter 11, verse 39. He says, all of these were commended through their faith. They got to the finish line and God said, well done. Good job, good and faithful servant. And in fact, he sticks them out in front of us as examples for which we ought to pattern our lives. So he connects these two passages, chapter 12 and chapter 11, with the word therefore, and then he starts to interject some different constructions, and it's kind of hard for us to see in the English text exactly where he's going. In the Greek, it's just a little bit easier, so I've put it indented for us to see kind of what's going on there. Therefore, let us run with endurance the race that's set before us. That's his main point. That's his main thrust. These have all run well. Now they're passing the baton, and it's your turn to run. That's his big idea. That's what he's driving at. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Why? Well, because we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Well, how? Well, by laying aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely to us, and by looking to Jesus, the one who was the originator and the one who is the completer of our faith. But the main idea here is, it's your turn to run, so put on your running shoes. It's your leg of the journey, and we want you to run well. So that's what's going on here. And as we begin to move through this, this is the one that he's emphasizing for us, to run with endurance the race that's set before us. So how is it that we're supposed to navigate life's long road? He says first that we must run as those who are enrolled in a race. Looking at that main phrase, that main clause that he says, therefore, let us run with endurance the race that's set before us. We've got to run. The first strategy for us to finish and navigate well and finish strong is that we've got to run like we're in a race. Well, that's a pretty simple metaphor when you stop and think about it, but it's a pretty profound metaphor when we stop and take a look at it. The word that he uses for run, let us run, is the idea of exerting oneself to the limit of your power in an attempt to move forward. It's a striving to advance. And so he says, this isn't a mid-morning constitutional. This isn't something that I get out and do a couple jumping jacks and I'm on my way. This is something that I've got to do the stretches for. This is something that I've got to do the work up to. This is something that is going to require every effort for me to move and make effort and make progress in this race. He says, it's your turn to run. It's not your turn to lollygag. It's not your turn to stick your hands in your pockets and enjoy the scenery on the way down life's road. It's your turn to gird up your loins and get your mind in the frame to run. Because there's a race in front of you. The others are done. They can't come back and run again. Their leg is done. It's your turn. The baton is in your hand. And everybody's watching you. It's not a back scratcher. It's something that you're taking and moving down that length to hand on to the next person. The word that he says, we're to run with endurance a race. The word race there is the word agon. It's the beginning of the word agony that we have in English. When you think of something that's agony, you don't usually think of something that's very pleasant. And he says, this is a race that you're in. It's an agon. The other word that's used rather than race is a struggle. It's a contest. It's a competition. It's a wrestling match. It's going to require all of your effort because there's big stakes in this competition. The biblical standard, MacArthur says, for holy living is a race, not a morning constitutional. A race is not a thing of passive luxury, but it's demanding, sometimes grueling, agonizing, requires our utmost in self-discipline, determination, and perseverance. We're in a race that is strenuous. We're in a race that is continuous. But the idea here is meant to give us a hope for success rather than to overwhelm us with the length of the journey and what's going to be required. This isn't a sprint. This is a marathon. And as he lays this out for us, this race, with the hope of finishing well, he's giving us a hope, not a draining of that hope. De Silva says this, in both the race or the contest and the membership, it's in an essentially voluntary group, a person willingly chooses to endure physical discomfort. And De Silva connects the idea that he's been developing through the book of Hebrews that these people are members of a society in which they fit as Christians, but they don't fit with the larger society of Hellenism or Greek culture, and they don't fit in the other society of Jewish culture. So they have voluntarily entered into a new group of people, a people that are submitting themselves to physical discomfort, submitting themselves to the reproaches of a trainer, curbing luxury, turning aside from many delights that others enjoy, but those who are non-athletes enjoy, or those who don't fully participate in this striving culture. The metaphor of athletic competition also brings something to the experience of the minority culture. To those inside, it provides for the recipient of society's censure and hostility an essential reorientation to that experience, turning a victim into a competitor and raising his dignity. So here's these people who have been Christians, have become Christians. They've taken on the name of Christianity, and because they've taken on the name of Christianity, they have become oppressed. They have become buffeted. He talks about that their property has been spoiled, that some have been thrown in prison, that they've been treated shamefully because they've been connected to others who have been thrown in prison. And so they do have the opportunity at this point and say, woe is me. I'm a part of the beleaguered minority called Christians. Poor me. And he says, no, listen, you got it all backward. Yes, you're a part of this minority group called Christians, but you don't understand what you've entered. You've entered into the few, the proud, the Marines. You've entered into God's chosen special forces. And it's your nature because it's your mission to succeed. And so as a competitor in the race, this is what is your duty. This is what you must do if you would enter these ranks. And so he says, yes, you're beaten up, but guess what? Get used to it, because that's what you've entered into. That's what you've signed on for. Does a soldier cry and run away when he gets shot at? Good grief. That's what he enlisted for. So let me at him. And that's the effect that he's trying to instill in us. You're hurting? Oh, poor you. Shut up and start running and start taking aim and start making progress and move forward. He says, get used to it, because this is what you've signed up for. This is what it looks like. The athletic imagery turns debilitating experiences into endurable ones, since there is now the prospect of victory. Even if that victory is only to be attained not by turning the tables on the enemy, but merely by enduring to the end of the contest. In the end, victory is attained insofar as the one suffering external assaults does not allow them to alter his internal convictions and commitments to do what he knows to be just and right. He says, yes, you're hurting. Yes, you're suffering. Yes, this is difficult. But guess what? It's supposed to be. You're in a conflict. You're in a race. You're on a journey. And it's not done yet. You're in the middle of the battle. So you want a timeout. Guess what? There's no timeouts. How many moms we got here? We're going to celebrate you next week, all right? Is there any timeouts in motherhood? There's not. There's timeouts for dad. It's called work, okay? He goes and, I'll tell you what, I would rather have to go to work than have to be responsible for raising the children that God has gifted mothers to be able to do. I would make a lousy mother, I promise you. And so would you, dad, okay? But God has gifted mothers. But there's no reprieve from motherhood. There's no reprieve in this Christian life from being a Christian. One of the things that we need to make clear, though, is that there's two distinctions to this race. Number one, we don't compete against each other. Okay? We're comrades in arms. We try to be the best soldier that we can be, but the soldier next to you might have training in marksmanship, whereas your training might be in communications. Does that make him a better soldier? No, it means he's got a different job than you. We're on the same team. We're moving the same direction. We're fighting the same enemy. We're not competing against each other, but each of us are striving to be all that we can be in God's army. A second distinction that we need to make note of is that we do not compete in our own strength. We're competing with the enemy, but we're not competing with the enemy in our strength. And so Paul says, I want you to understand that we're wrestling, but we're not wrestling against flesh and blood. So we can't wrestle with the strength of flesh and blood. That's why we have to look unto Jesus, the one who begins and finishes that life that we live by faith. So by nature, this race is hard. By nature, this race is long. He tells us in that phrase, let us run with patience the race that's set before us. He tells us how we're supposed to run. We're supposed to run with endurance. That word endurance means to maintain a belief or a course of action in the face of opposition. It's to stand one's ground, to hold out, to remain steadfast, to persevere. Okay. Is it difficult to stand fast when there's nothing pushing against you? It's not a big deal. But you ever been in a stream that's been moving fast and pushing you downstream? You ever tried to just stand there? You have to lean into it. It takes everything that you can do just to stand on your feet while everything is pushing again. That's what it is to endure. He says, does it feel like there's pressure in your life? Oh, guess what? There is. So you know what the prescription is? Get out of the water. Get out of the pressure. Not it at all. He says, the prescription that I have for you is to stand fast. Lean into that pressure. Lean into those waves. Don't lose your ground. Yes, there's opposition. That shouldn't hit you by surprise. The definition is the capacity to hold out or to bear up in the face of difficulty. Endurance without difficulty isn't really endurance. Anybody can do that. It's just standing there. But standing in the face of opposition, now that's endurance. That's fortitude. That's steadfastness. And that's what we're called to do. To run away from the hardship for which one has enrolled, would be a dereliction of duty. You really want AWOL typed across your name when you get into heaven? Let me see your duty card. How'd it go? Oh, went AWOL. Yeah, nice. Acts chapter 14, verse 21, 22. Paul and Barnabas had just gone through the different towns, and then they've come to the end, and they're turning around and going back. And when they had preached the gospel to that city and had made many disciples, they returned down to Lystra, to Iconium, and back to Antioch. They were strengthening the souls of the disciples, and they encouraged them to continue in the faith. And here's how they encouraged them, by saying that through many tribulations we must enter the kingdom of God. Wow, thanks. But you know what? Wouldn't you rather know that there's an enemy than to find it out by accident? Wouldn't you rather know that you need to strap up and get into the battle than to find it out by accident when you're laying on your back and that one's with his breathing down your neck and he's got the bayonet at your throat? Wouldn't you rather know that there's an enemy and be prepared for that enemy? That's encouraging. Then I can stand rather than having my feet wiped out from underneath me. And we would like to think that the pain and the weariness that we endure are somehow unique to us. One of the truths about pain is that it always makes you feel alone. Whenever I'm sick, I feel alone. And I just want to be alone. Okay? But one of the things that when you hurt, you feel like nobody else knows what I'm going through. Nobody else knows how bad this feels. Nobody else knows what it feels like to have this constraint of tight finances. Or a misunderstanding in a relationship. Or a temptation that I can't seem to conquer. Nobody else understands the pressures that I have in life to succeed and perform. Nobody understands the pressures. We would like to think that these are unique to us. We'd like to think that somehow we have a right to be bitter about our current conditions because they don't fall into the category of ease that we consider to be life's norm. You look at other people when you're in the middle of hurting and trials, and you think, why can't my life just be like Jason's? Why can't my life just be like Sam's? If my life was like Frank's, man, I would be on easy street. Don't we think like that? We look around us and we think, oh, life is normal for everybody else because nobody else has problems like I do. Normal means easy. And he's writing and saying, wrong, upside down. Normal means hard. Normal means long. So what are you going to do? Quit? Of course not. You're going to keep on going. But you know what? Sometimes we just need that encouragement to keep on going. To keep on keeping on. And that's what he's striving to provide for us. Nothing could be further than the truth that when we're in the middle of these tough times, that we're being disciplined, that we're somehow disconnected from God. And he's going to talk about it in the following verses, that God is disciplining us. And we think of discipline as reprimanding. Discipline means being willing to go through that which is tough in order to enable me to be equipped for that which is tough. So when I discipline my body to run far, guess what I have to do? I have to begin to run short, and then more and more, and I'm disciplining my body. I'm hurting on purpose so that I can endure something bigger later on. And that's what God's doing for us. We'll be successful only in proportion to the extent that we submit ourselves to the pain and endure it. Let me say that again. Success for you will be defined by your ability to embrace the pain and endure it. Do you like that? You can shake your head this way or this way. Do you like that? That's how you spell success? How do you spell relief? R-O-L-A-I-D-S. Okay. How do you spell success? P-A-I-N. H-A-R-D. Oh, okay. Here we go. Buckle up your boots. We're marching. But you know what? We aren't an enduring people. We are an indulgent people. We like to think that life revolves around us. We spend most of our lives, do we not, trying to get problems out of our lives, trying to make life easier for us. That's one of the benefits for me of exercise. I don't do a lot of them. I've chosen one. Do push-ups. I don't like push-ups. but I do push-ups because I don't like to do push-ups. Because it lets me do something that I don't want to do and get it done. And it gets me in a frame of mind of, you know what? There's going to be other things today that I've got to do that I don't want to do. But I've got to suck it up and get it done. So that we're not an indulgent creature, but we become an enduring creature. Thirdly, this race by nature is a planned race. He said, let us run with endurance the race that is what? It's set before us. It's laid out before us. Who does the charting of the race course? The runner or somebody else? Somebody else, because there's more than one runner in the race. That somebody else is usually the official, the one who's in charge, and he sets up this course and lays it out with common boundaries to ensure proper achievement. He lays it out to provide a perspective of a goal or a destination, and it's put on public display. And that's what that word means. It's set out in front of us. It's laid out by the officials so that you know where you're supposed to go, you know how you're supposed to get there, and you know when you've arrived. They've laid it out. Sometimes does it feel like your journey is a little bit chaotic and not very well laid out? Sometimes it feels like that. But the truth is that wherever your feet land on this path called life, that has been prepared for you by whom? By God. God has laid out this life in front of you in such a way that you cannot get off it. Now, we can do poorly in this race called life, but when we do, he gets our attention and helps us to learn the lessons that we need to in order to keep on moving. We can slow down the process, but we can't get off the track. Guaranteed. Because this track has been laid out. Now, guess what? This track might look different for all of us, but really, it's the same. Go back in the book of Hebrews, back to chapter 2. Chapter 2, verse 10. It's talking about Jesus in verse 9, who is crowned with glory and honor. And he's crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death. so that by the grace of God, Jesus would taste the death for all mankind. Now look what he says in verse 10. Now it was fitting for Jesus, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, that he should make the founder of their salvation, or the pioneer of their salvation, perfect through what? Perfect through suffering. Guess what this race looks like for Jesus? Perfect through suffering. Guess what your race is going to look like? Perfect through suffering. It's a race that's been laid out for you, but it's a race that Jesus ran ahead of you, and he ran it successfully. 1 Peter chapter 4 says, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar that you share Christ's sufferings, so that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed." You know what? We have to run as those that are enrolled in a race that we know is going to be hard, a race that we know is going to be long, but a race that we must be confident has been planned and prepared for us by none other than the author of our salvation, Jesus Christ. That race is perfect through suffering. Second game strategy for us to win this race is we must run as those who are surrounded by witnesses. We're back in Hebrews chapter 12. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us," and he goes on, we must run as those who are surrounded by witnesses. This word witnesses has kind of a double intention, a double entendre, has a double meaning for us. Those who are witnesses of a race, we tend to think of as those who are spectators. And we could think of that, and we will think that way in just a minute, but that's not how these witnesses have functioned so far in the story. As he comes down in verse 39 of chapter 11, "All these were commended through their faith. They did not receive what was promised." They were commended. They received a commendation. They became martyrs, witnesses of the fact that there is a God, and God is good. God is powerful, and that God's perfection in the end is going to be worth the suffering that we go through here on planet Earth. They have become witnesses. Witnesses that point the way, witnesses that direct us, showing us how we too ought to function in life. And so these are those who've already succeeded. On the one hand, they're not looking at us, but we're looking at them, MacArthur says. "Seeing how God was with them encourages us to trust that God will be also with us. The same God who was their God is our God. The God of yesterday is the God of today and the God of tomorrow. He has not weakened or lost interest in his people. He has not lessened his love or his care for them. We can run as well as they did. And it has nothing to do with how we compare with them, but in how our God compares with their God." And so as we look at Noah living in the middle of a perverse generation, and we look around at our generation, we can say, you know what? I can do it because Noah did it, because Noah did it by the grace of God. And that's how I'm going to succeed. I can look at David, who fell on his face, but God still called him a man after my own heart. I can look at Samson, who's a horrible example, and yet God says, this is one of my heroes of the faith. I can look at Gideon. We can look at the others, that Moses and others that God has given us here, and says, you know what? How did they succeed? By looking not at the circumstances around them, but looking at the one who is invisible, and seeing him more clearly than everything else of life that surrounded them. That's how we've got to go forward. That's how they did, and that's how you've got to do it. But not only are these the ones who point the way forward, these are the ones who one day we will look back with. You see that phrase right at the end of chapter 11, verse 40. God has provided something better for us, Jesus in heaven, so that apart from us, all of these who have preceded, who've won the race, who've won by faith, they won't be made perfect without us. In other words, we will be made perfect with them. as those who've entered, the few, the proud, the Christians, one day in the victor's circle, we'll be sitting across from David, Samson, Gideon. We'll be sitting across from Paul, Peter, Luke. We'll be sitting across from those who ran well. We'll be sharing stories. And we'll be looking back on life and saying, you know what, God was good to me in this time. You never heard of the city of Philadelphia, but, or maybe you did, but it was the wrong Philadelphia. This is the one with the Eagles. So, and that we're going to be comparing notes, and we're going to say, here's what God did for me in my day. What did God do for you? Oh, I never heard that story. That one's not in the Bible. That's incredible. God did what? That's amazing. What the author of the book of Hebrews is trying to do for us at this point, and he's been doing it all through the book, he's trying to help us to remember that you do belong to a community. Now, what do we have here today? 70 people? Okay. This isn't a very big community, especially if you've come from a larger church. But the encouragement isn't that this community is large. He says, you belong to a community that's had thinning ranks ever since it was begun. But it doesn't mean that they're unsuccessful. They're just successful on the other side. And so you are part of the winner's circle, even though you don't have a large body with whom you commune just today. But you're going to be a part of the elite who've walked through that Jordan called death and have landed on the other side as victors in the royal city of Almighty God. You'll be among those who wear the crown. And one day, they're going to ask you, how'd your race go? And so, while oftentimes the temptation is to view these who've gone before us as those who are sitting on the grandstand in the skies, I think Ron Hamilton's song says. Now they watch us from grandstands. They don't watch us from grandstands in the skies. They could care less right now today how I'm living life. They're at Jesus for crying out loud. They're worshiping. They could care less about what we're doing down here on planet Earth. But one day when we get together with them in that winner's circle, I'm going to be asked by Moses, so Ryan, how'd your race go? And someday as I'm comparing notes with Moses, I say, Moses, you did great, man. You turned down Pharaoh's daughter and you became one of these hated Hebrew children and you were rejected and you were thrown out. I didn't like that so much, so I just kind of went with the flow. I just tried to fit in the culture. I didn't want to make too many waves. That wasn't politically correct in my day. You don't quite understand that political correct stuff, but we really kind of have to operate that in the 21st century. And so I didn't do this whole sticking out like a sore thumb like you did. My faith was a little more incognito. Say, oh, really? That's interesting. That's too bad. And there is, as he's setting up for us, he's saying, listen, you belong to a group of winners. And one day, they're going to ask you how you ran. You already know how they ran. And you know what? They ran successfully without all that you have to run with. They didn't have Jesus in heaven waiting for them, interceding for them. All they had was pictures. All they had was something that they had to slice its throat every single year, every single week, sometimes every single day as they were sinning. Your sins done once, forever, gone. They didn't have these reassurances that you and I have because God has provided something better for us. And we with them will be made perfect. The author uses the strategy of drawing attention to the presence of spectators who will witness one's performance. Either for praise or censure, the strategy has the effect of reminding the hearers of who is watching their choices and whose opinion really matters regarding their choices. Rather than seeing themselves surrounded by a cloud of unsupportive, censorious, and hostile neighbors who want them to resume living by the world's standards, the author wants the Christian to see themselves surrounded by the host of the faithful in every age who have run the race with excellence and whose lives bear testimony to the reality of the prize for which we all strive together. That's God's second strategy for us to run successfully. A third game plan or strategy for us is that we must run as those who desire to win. I love this. MacArthur says, nothing makes less sense than to be in a race that you have little desire to win. Yet I believe the lack of desire to win is a basic problem with many Christians. We are content simply to be saved and to wait to go to heaven. Ouch. You ever thought that way? I'm saved. Now I'm just waiting so I can go to heaven. He says, you've missed the whole point. You're in a race. Don't you want to win it? You're in a struggle. Don't you want to succeed? Oh, I know I'll get there. He says, listen, we've got to run like we want to win. So what does that look like? It looks like up there in verse 1, let us also then lay aside every weight and the sin which clings so closely to us, so that we can run with endurance the race that's set before us. The first thing he says is that we need to lay aside some weights. These weights are hindrance. They're anything that would slow us down, weigh us down, divert our attention, sap our energy, dampen our enthusiasm for the things of God. These weights aren't necessarily sins in and of themselves, but they're sins that they're things that become sinful for us because they hinder us in the race. You ever wondered why sometimes it seems like somebody can do something, but you can't get away with it? God won't let you for some reason. God won't let you have that same focus, that same attention, that same whatever. For you, it's a weight. For you, it's a hindrance. But brother X down the road can do it. He doesn't even think about it. In fact, it seems like he's enjoying life as he's going on his merry way. How does that function? How does that work? Is X a sin? Well, it might be. And for you, it is, apparently. But these are the things that in and of themselves, like Paul said, meat. Meat isn't by itself wrong or right. It's just meat. But when I try to eat meat that's been sacrificed for an idol, my conscience won't let me do that. I'm thinking about this divinity that this has been offered to. Before God, I can't eat it. But Brother X down the road here sits there and enjoys the whole thing. Medium rare, rare, well done, however he likes his meat. He eats it, even though it's been sacrificed. Paul says, listen, it's just meat. Okay? But for me, that meat, which isn't sinful by itself, has become something that hinders me in my moving forward in the race. The problem is not with what the weight is, but in what the weight does. It keeps us from running well and therefore from winning. Is there anything wrong with computers? Yes, I hate them. They're stupid. But guess what? I have to use them, okay? Is there anything wrong with computers? Not in and of themselves. But might you have to limit yourself on the time on your computer in a way that somebody else doesn't have? You might. Your computer might actually be something that is hindering you from moving forward in your Christian life. Is a cell phone bad? Not by itself. It may be something that you have to put limits on. Is a television bad? Not in and of itself, but you may have to put limits on it. It may be actually hindering you from other things. The problem is not the thing in itself, but what it does, which is particularly damaging when the endurance is the factor. You know what? There's a lot of things that I can spend time at, I can spend time on, but not everything benefits me in my walk with the Lord. In fact, a lot of stuff eats up my time, and I come to the end of the day and I say, why did I spend my time like that? There were so many other things I could have and should have spent my time doing. And the things that I did weren't wrong, but they just didn't help me make any progress in where I'm going on this road called life. Now, there's a couple different sides of hindrances, things that would be okay in and of themselves, but they keep us from running well. The first set of hindrances are those that are represented by Judaism, the legalism, and the external religiosity, the things that say, I'm okay because I'm doing good. We can actually be doing good and hindering our spiritual walk because we're trusting in the good that we're doing. The other side of things is represented by the Hellenistic culture. It's the license and a false spirituality. It says, I'm okay regardless of what I do. So Jesus gets me in, so I don't have to worry about anything else. I'm just free sailing. I'm not thinking about these things because God's taking care of it. and I've got license. He said, listen, you can be so hampered in your Christian life, living by a false sense of guilt, and you can be so hampered in your Christian life without any sense of guilt. Both of these things can become hindrances as you're trying to live life and make progress. The truth is that we're only ever okay because of the work of Jesus, and consequently, what we do makes a great deal of difference, as it will either enable us or hinder us from experiencing Him and His abundant life. You ever stop and think that some of the hindrances that we have in life are other people? Now flip it on the other side. Have you ever wondered if other people's hindrances might be you? You know what? The Bible says that we need to lay aside those weights that hinder, that slow us down. De Silva suggests these weights for the first century believers that they may have to abandon. Number one was their reputation. A reputation, the Bible says, a good name is to be chosen above great riches. But when my reputation has to be guarded at every expense so that I'm more concerned about my reputation than about the reputation of Jesus, that becomes a hindrance. Their physical well-being. Well, how many of us like to be hurt? Not many that I know of. Not many masochists in the crowd. Okay? But he says, sometimes you may have to give up self-preservation in order to preserve the identity of Christ. Sometimes it was their property. Having property in this world does something to your heart. It can't help but do something to your heart. So what does Jesus say? Lay up your treasure in heaven, where moth and rust doesn't corrupt. Mark it down. The more you have, the more it will require your attention, your focus. And so Jesus says, lay up treasures in heaven. But here's something that's interesting. In situations of lesser tension between church and society, the weights may become more insidious. It's pretty obvious. When world bad, Christian good. It's black and white. Choices are easy. But when I live in a culture where Christians don't look much different from non-Christians, guess what? The ease of the culture in which you live can be so deceptive that we don't even know what those weights are. They might be wrapping up, and that's the picture that he uses next. The sin that clings so closely to us. And he doesn't say which sin. He uses the word, the article in there. And it's sin. Any sin. And it talks about how it clings close. It's like that, like the vine that climbs up the trunk of the tree and ends up expiring the life of the tree because it clings so closely that it controls tightly. And he says, you understand, do you not, that when you actively choose sin, that it wrings the life out of your Christian walk. It keeps you from being able to make progress spiritually. And so he says, listen, if you are going to succeed in the Christian life, you've got to run like one who wants to win it. You can't be flirting with sin. You can't even be giving a lot of time to things that don't help you move forward. You've got to give those up. You've got to give up the extra coat. You can't put on a parka when you're in a marathon. The parka's got to go. You've got to put on something light that's going to enable you to move. A fourth strategy that we see here is that we must run as those who keep their eyes fixed on the prize. So he says down in verse 2, looking to Jesus, the founder and the perfecter of our faith. We'll see that this is a fixed look. He tells us to look, and the idea here is a determined vision. It's fixing one's eyes or attention upon something so that we're not distracted. The idea is to develop a more precise knowledge of something that's, Bedeg says, it's in the offing. It's that part of the sea which is beyond the shore and beyond the anchoring area. It's out there, and you're seeing as far as you can see on the horizon. And it's looking and being careful to look and studying so that you don't lose it. It's if you've ever been out away from the shore so that you can't see the shore. As you get closer to the shore, you can just see it, and then you can't, and then you can, and then you keep your eye on that so you don't lose sight of that direction that you're supposed to be headed. And that's the idea of fixing that look. It's a fixed look. It's a unique look. It's looking at the one who is the founder and the perfecter of our faith. It's focusing on one thing and one thing only. We have the idea that if I'm going to succeed, I can't think about, I need to focus on not sinning. You ever tried this one? Don't think about pink elephants. Well, as soon as I say the word pink elephants, what comes to mind? Pink elephant. Now don't think about pink elephants. Try. Don't think about pink elephants. What are you thinking about? Well, you're thinking about pink elephants. And the more I tell you don't think about pink elephants, the more you think about pink elephants. Okay? The idea here isn't so focus on sin and try to stay away from it. He says, if you look at Jesus, you're running away from sin. It just works that way. So fix your eye on one thing, make it Jesus. He's the one who's the founder or the originator, the leader, the pioneer, the trailblazer of faith. You want to know what faith looks like? He's given us all these examples. But you want to know what it looks like best? It looks like Jesus, who said, Father, I wish that you would take this cup from me. It's going to hurt so bad. But not what I want, but what you want. Father, and he prays such a prayer of faith, and he says, this is how I want you to succeed. So look at Jesus. It's a transforming look. He wants us to see what Jesus endured. He comes up to later on in verse 2. Looking at Jesus, the one who begins and ends, the one who founds and perfects our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured a cross. The word the isn't in there, it's a. He endured a cross. We think of it as the cross because it's the cross upon which Jesus died. But many people were hung on a cross. The cross was the most barbaric, most painful, the most embarrassing and shameful death that somebody could die. And if we're going to look at Jesus, we have to know what we're looking for. Jesus died on a cross. The form of execution called crucifixion was calculated to leave the victim utterly stripped of dignity and worth in the eyes of the world. It was the vilest, most degrading death possible. As the crucified was hung up before all the world, precisely as an example of how not to be. A shameful death was the most feared of all evils among many ancients because it left one without any opportunity to regain one's honor. The last word on one's life was a judgment of worthlessness. Why do I spend so much time trying to preserve my reputation when Jesus gave up all of his reputation and died on a cross? The more I look like Jesus, the less I'm worried about what I look like. It was a lonely death. It says he endured a contradiction of sinners against himself. We see not only what he endured, we see why he endured. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. You know, if you don't have something in front of you that's worthwhile in the race, you're not going to run it, or you're not going to run it long, or you're not going to run it well. And so there has to be something that's worth finishing for. What was the joy that Jesus had in front of him? Well, we see in verse 3. No, we see at the end of verse 2. Today he's seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Jesus knew that there was going to be perfection, that there was going to be glorification, that there was going to be joy at the right hand of God forever. Psalm 16, verse 11. In your presence are pleasures forevermore. Jesus knew that. And because of those pleasures, it enabled him to go through what he endured. That's why he endured what he endured. Is heaven going to be worth it? Paul thought so. He said, I can't imagine but that the suffering that we have today cannot be compared to the glory that's waiting for us just around the corner. You believe that? Baloney. If you believed it, you wouldn't whine and complain about how bad it hurts today. Hey, but the trick is, we've got to believe it. We do believe that. We believe it up here. It's got to get down to here. We've really got to believe it. And that's what keeps us going. When everything else in us says, give up, quit, walk away. We endure by seeing what he endured. We endure by seeing why he endured. We endure by seeing how he endured. It says that for the joy that was set before him, he endured a cross, despising shame. Shame signifies a sensitivity toward public opinion. That sensitivity that moves people to act as the crowd would want you to act, or not act the way the crowd doesn't want you to act. So with peer pressure, there's shame. Shame that moves you to do something or not to do something. And basically what the writer of the book of Hebrews here is saying, choose your peers carefully. If your peers are those who are victors in God's kingdom, you're going to be pressed, you're going to be pressured, you're going to be moved to do one thing. But if those people who live here on planet Earth and their voices are the loudest in your head, you are going to be pressed and conformed into looking like them. You know what Jesus said of this present world? I don't care what they say, I'm doing what the Father tells me to do. And so, he uses a term here in verse 3. He endured from sinners hostility against himself. The word sinners means those who violate group code. Those who violate group value. And if I belong to somebody who doesn't have the same values of my group, I would be an offender. I would be a sinner. Jesus endured the contradiction of sinners against him. Who was right, them or Jesus? Jesus was. So why would I make their opinion so important in my life? So they've got the wrong values to start out with. It's not that you want to put your finger in their eye, but they've got no control over your life. If you're going to be a victor like Jesus was a victor, you've got to see how he endured. He didn't care what people thought about him. That couldn't move him to be anything different from who he was. Finally, he says in verse 3, consider. Or the word is reconsider. Look again. Look and look back and look at a different angle and look from it upside down. And look when you're hurting, look when you're not hurting. Look and look again so that you can see Jesus. Why? So that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. There's a danger as we're running down this road called life. What we're running with isn't legs. What we're running with is a heart. What we're running with is a spirit. What we're running with is that which is inside. And so the book of Proverbs says, keep your heart with all diligence, for out of your heart comes every issue of life. There's a danger on this road that your heart will give out. Not that you'll have a heart attack, but that it will start to love something else, or that it will become so weak that you can't keep on keeping on. The idea here is weary of soul, or soul fatigue. The idea is to waste away, to become spent, and to fall ill, and sometimes even unto death. It's to be faint, to be exhausted of strength, and thus to give up. In fact, the one translation says, lest you get soul fatigue and drop out of the race. The one who drops out of the race stands exactly in opposition to that great cloud of witnesses that finished the race. And so he says, listen, if you would be in that winner's circle with those who finish the race well, you can't drop out. You can't quit. In fact, these who finish well are called martyrs, witnesses. And eventually that idea came to mean one who dies for what they believe. They testify to the reality of it. Of their own free choice, would rather die for their religion or their belief to save their lives than to save their lives by renouncing it. The state brought on by this soul fatigue endangers one in this condition to commit spiritual suicide, to throw in the towel. He does exactly what Jesus says. He loses his life by saving it here in this life. And so, as we move forward, the goal today is life's long road requires a lifelong game plan. We are disciples of Jesus Christ. We're followers of Jesus. So what does that mean? Well, we must follow Jesus. I'm sorry it's that simple, but that's really that simple. Okay? It's maybe not uniquely profound, but guess what? It is uniquely effective. When you are not succeeding in Christian life, you know what you're not looking at? Jesus. I don't have to have a PhD in anything to say that. God says that. Because when you look unto Jesus, the author and finisher of your faith, he will see that you stand on this road called life.